This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
You can't live on welfare, but if you go to a small enough town where no one wants to live and it's 120 degrees in the summer, then you can get really low rent.
I mean, I loved the fact that here I was cooking for this $100 million corporation, in a sense. And for Garcia, I was cooking things like hot dogs.
From Burroughs, I got this notion ages ago of the third mind.
Here's one with Tim Leary. He was really quite a cat.
And so when you're in an atmosphere like that with a bunch of people sort of reinventing their cultural universe and just going wild, I mean...
Okay, there's some fun ones with Wavy Gravy, Mickey Hart, Lyle Lovett.
Work is everything.
It is the most marvelous dance.
Hello, and welcome to the most marvelous dance. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. And today we've got a show about transformational journeys through the counterculture.
The counterculture, which is an appropriate subject for living in Northern California, where in Sebastopol we have an auto repair shop called Earth in Upheaval. But what the hell is the counterculture? Other than something that makes money for the dominant culture and the purveyors and the packagers and the vendors of the next big thing.
Next big things don't have a really long shelf life anymore.
I think it took Christianity a couple of hundred years before it even started to be a big thing, and a whole lot longer before anybody really made any significant bucks out of it. Whereas now, the supermarket bestsellers, if they don't sell, they don't even send the books back. They just tear off the front covers and send the distributor back the covers and toss the books into the dumpster. This is what authors aspire to.
Nevertheless, the counterculture has got a long history. It goes clear back in this country to the very first white guys pulling their rowboats up on the beach and wrecking the neighborhood.
They're wearing beards, after all. Yeah, whoever thought of wearing white skin in America? And the traditions of Tom Paine and Thoreau and Walt Whitman and the abolitionists and the Wobblies and the communists and the hipsters and the Beats and the hippies and the Jesus freaks. Trace your own lineage.
Well, there is a movement. There's always been one, a subculture, something that makes a splash and somehow shifts the social paradigm, and it has its headliners. But behind the scenes, who does the work? Who cooks the food? Who does the typesetting, the proofreading? Who drives the bus?
And so today, the counterculture as seen from the perspectives of a cook, a maker of books, and a bus driver.
First, the chef.
Ray Sewell, some call me Shea Ray, some call me Knucklehead, Chef Ray, many names, many hats.
Ray Sewell's journey into the counterculture has been an unusual route. Classical French cuisine.
I'm a native San Franciscan. My mom was a bohemian. She moved from the Northwest, an intellectual freak that didn't fit in until she got to San Francisco and hung out in North Beach. And that sort of set the tone and a direction that I've been following ever since. I've sort of been drawn to what I consider brilliance and try and hang out with it as much as possible, hoping that it will rub off at least some on me, and that remains to be seen. I was trained under some of the most talented chefs in the planet, actually three black hat chefs, very unusual. I'm called a third generation Escoffier from the master Auguste Escoffier. His apprentice was my teacher's teacher. I was academically very poor, extremely dyslexic in high school, and so they put me into shuttled me off into a culinary program. But I had a passion for it, and so I took a shot and went and applied for this program that was being announced. It was brand new in the Bay Area to train chefs. I applied for this program in high school. There was 600 kids. Only five chefs were certified to train, five Swiss chefs, and willing to take on one apprentice each. I remember getting up to the line, and you got to the front of the line, and there was a panel there that would give you a quick interview. It was a chef from Austria and a Frenchman named Louis and George Bolag, who was the Swiss chef who had recently broke his leg. So he had this huge cane that he would slap on the table and holler, "Next!" And which would intimidate you to no end. So as I came upon the panel here, I was nervous as heck, and I didn't really know anything. And they asked me a series of questions. One of them was, have you ever cooked sweetbreads, which are actually glands? And I just assumed it was baking. So I said, well, I've done a little bit of baking. So he knew right away I didn't know much, which turned out to be a plus. But at that moment, he looked at my hands and started wrestling me around. And I was a wrestler, so I would wrestle back with him a little bit, and he liked that. And so he chose me right then on the spot. And later he told me that it was because I have chef's hands, same hands that he has, same hands his teacher had. And that was a huge factor in it. You'd be able to, you know, handle the task. It is the most marvelous dance. You have to consider that there might be, 10 dinner tickets hanging with 2 to 6 people per dinner ticket. And so each item is prepared individually in a pan. And so you have to start these off. You have to rotate them as they cook. The dance goes from cold, prepped and ready, to cook, to then into the sauté pan, and then usually makes the rounds in the oven or on top of the stove for about 10 minutes, and then over to be finished off and placed on the plate. And the speed in which this is done, and the sensitivity and the timing, and in sauces, for instance, there's a moment of reduction where you reduce the liquid, the wine, the stock, and whatever else you have in the pan down to just almost a syrup. If you take it any further, it'll burn. If you don't take it far enough, you won't get the flavor. So it's very finite. But each pan requires that. Each order requires that. So you're rotating this constantly in a speed that is just, you know, you've got to hustle it out. The tables are waiting, people, you know, managers and owners and pushing you. It's really quite intense, but it's so exciting that if you can master it, it's just the most marvelous sensation. You know, it's very gratifying, each order that goes out. It's really quite an art form.
He finished his apprenticeship, went to work for restaurants around the Bay Area while going to concerts at the Fillmore, Grateful Dead, etc. But he didn't really find his way into that other world until he found a different clientele to cook for.
At a certain point, I reached saturation where I was becoming a young rebel, and the times were dictating adventure, and so I had to get out. In 1972, left for Oregon and ended up moving next door to Kinkesey, just by chance. And that began a long journey of just meeting and cooking for and hanging out with people like Timothy Leary and Ram Dass and Ginsberg and Burroughs and Hunter Thompson and, you know, all these wacky dudes that were just brilliant and fun as heck. And there was a sort of a regular gig. People would come out to the farm, whether it was Garcia or anybody, and sit around the table. We'd all eat and then go out and feed the cows and then come back and smoke grass or whatever the heck we're doing. And that pretty much opened up the door to getting to cook for, like, the Grateful Dead and to get on the road with them. And it was quite a thing. Well, I think that in life, I think you have to come to terms with what it is you want to be, and then you have to go get it. And I'm so thrilled that I did. And in a lot of ways, it's very consistent with my mom's drive as she came out of the Midwest and moved to North Beach and tapped into the bohemian consciousness. I've just continued that, I believe. And family tradition, yeah, exactly. Well, you know, Kesey once said, referred to the Grateful Dead as God's band. You know, it was just the best of the best. And Yeah, it was just a tremendous thing. And people would bring offerings of food. Of course, we'd have to be careful because there's a lot of nutcases out there. But people would, you know, a man would catch a 60 to 80 pound king salmon and bring it down personally from Alaska because he had such a high appreciation for the dead. That was a great thing, you know, and the band loved it. And I mean, I loved the fact that here I was cooking for this $100 million corporation, in a sense. And for what most considered the main guy, Garcia, I was cooking things like hot dogs. And I just loved that. I just loved the thought that here I'm surrounded by a stadium of thousands of people and are just so enthralled with what's going on, and the source of this man's energy is a hot dog. But I came to terms with that many times. I mean, if God can create a brilliant human like Garcia and fuel him on chocolate cake and hot dogs, you know, who am I to judge that?
For the record, Jerry Garcia liked his hot dog charred, no sweet relish, only sour.
Well, really what I think it goes back to is, I refer to it as the feast, which is the genesis of celebration. You know, it goes back to gathering around the first fires after a hunt and, the marvelous progression that takes place during a feast where first you build a fire and then you're preparing food and the smells. And so people gather around the fire and they gather around the smells and right away you have a community. Then stories are told about the hunt or somebody looks funny and you laugh at them. And it's the essence of the human experience is born out of that. And I think a lot of the things that we do mimic that experience. You know, it's merely the feast. Food, story, and song. That's what it's about. But, it's all play. You know, mammals love to play. That's what I found out. And so any opportunity to play, it doesn't matter who they are, what their slant is, a conservative, straight, people love to play. I know that.
I asked, have you ever had memorable disasters?
Oh, many times. But the beautiful thing about cooking is that you can steer a monumental disaster into a positive thing if you just stay with it. I used to do these large festivals up in Oregon. I was flaming some Gramigné brandy, it's a cognac, and I got the flame so high that it caught the ceiling of my booth, which was full of leaves, on fire. And this is the middle. I've got 600 people. They're staring at me, and this is the moment. We're serving. Here, my booth is on fire, and so several of my cooks grabbed buckets of water and doused it down. But at the same time, it completely washed over all the food that we had just prepared, which took us hours. But the Flying Karamazov brothers were with us, so they dove in and began to juggle the burnt items throughout the kitchen, and it became a hilarious moment and a great diversion way you could rapidly put together some kind of product that would at least satisfy the masses, these starving, hungry faces looking at us in shock. We were at Autzen Stadium in Eugene, Oregon. It was Grateful Dead and Santana, and I was doing a barbecue scene not far from the stage, which is not really a good idea, as it turned out. Carlos just started to play, and I was cooking this chicken with this, I had this chili pumpkin seed rub on it, which was just killer smell, killer taste. But I dropped him onto the barbecue, and they just began to smoke like crazy. And the smoke bellowed up and ended up blowing onto the stage. The security guy's running over hollering at me, you got to get this stuff out of here, man. This is not good. But at that moment, I looked up and Carlos, I felt so embarrassed and, what a lame I am here. I got the smoke is covering the stage and, this is like, but what he did was started to look at the smoke and start jamming with it, and it was like, I called it the spirit of the sizzling dead chicken. And Carlos, with these eyes that have intensity and sage and looks like a wolf, he's just so focused on the smoke that's twirling around. It was, you know, Carlos, the sizzling dead chicken, and myself were jamming at that moment. You know, they had our moment there. And so later, when Carlos came off, I went up to apologize, and he said, "No, no, no." He thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, and I really love Carlos.
And we looked through photographs.
I can just sort of roll through. Yeah, just roll. I mean, here's one with Percy Sledge. He was out there singing in his powder blue performance jacket. And the show's over. He asks us to bring dinner up to his dressing room. I'm the only one in the dressing room with him. And he says, "Excuse me," before I sit down. He gets up and he goes in the other room and puts on his pink dinner jacket and comes out and sits down to eat dinner. I thought, man, this guy, man, let's see who else we got in here. Here's Vince Welnick from the Grateful Dead. And Vince, I remember when he came onto the scene with the band, he really enjoyed eating. He loved just the whole idea of he could have whatever he wanted. And so during the break, we would set up a really gorgeous white tablecloth thing up on stage for him. And during the break, he would take his break eating there. Here's one with Tim Leary. He was really quite a cat. You know, he could talk to anybody. He was just so sweet. He would get down to your level and engage with you. And I remember one time we all went to a football game with Keezy and Ken Babbs and Leary. And I thought, geez, this is just what a crew to go to the football game with. And the police are out in the street directing tons of traffic. And somebody in the car lights up a joint. And so we had to roll the windows up because the cops were out there, you know. And I was thinking, and it was, you know, that day it was like 100 degrees, so it was like 150 in the car. And we're just drenched in sweat, but we can't roll the window down because there's this smell of weed out there. And I remember thinking that here I am with some of the smartest people on the planet, and we're doing one of the dumbest things you can do, you know. And it was always that kind of contrast. I catered a Walt Disney movie called Never Cry Wolf, and this was Zachary, the shaman in the story, and he was my roommate also, and he only spoke Yubik, but we ended up having this terrific ability to communicate without words, and we laughed constantly. The man was just such a beautiful human, but I ended up feeding him hot dogs and spaghetti and everything else. You know, he never had anything like that. He was whale blubber man. Old Alaskan story. I was out with these nomadic tribes, and basically six of them come to my door and said, "Carl wants you to come with us." So we go out in this moose hunt. We knock this moose, and, you know, end up slitting the belly and pulling the liver out and eating it warm. All these things that, you know, I've never done in my life. We come back, and I prepared this traditional dish called agutak. And agutak was actually started out from, they would take the fat that lines the stomach of the caribou, whip it up into a froth in snow, so it's cold, add fresh berries to it. And that is the original Eskimo ice cream. And so I prepared agutak for this group of elders, which completely flipped them out, you know, that I would prepare such a thing, let alone, you know, they don't get it very much. Marie Muldaw, David Nelson Band. Okay, there's some fun ones with Wavy Gravy, Mickey Hart, Lyle Lovett. Yeah, Lyle Lovett was a fragile kind of guy. He's a thin little man. I was always worried about hugging
with
him.
The monks.
I had a restaurant in Oregon, and I had agreed to feed the troop of monks. So this is like right before Christmas, and we're closing the restaurant because we're going to a Christmas party. And I get a phone call and say, "We're going to be there in about an hour." and it turned out they had 40 monks coming in an hour. So I was like, it finally came to me that, oh, geez, you know, I just completely spaced it out. So I grabbed the last two employees that were going out the door and said, "You're not leaving. We're doing this giant feast, whether you like it or not." And I wasn't feeling that good at the time. I had some health problems. And at the end of the feast, you know, they were so grateful for it that they gave me this wonderful little vase that is sealed by the Dalai Lama, and it's for prosperity. And they said, the doors of prosperity will open when you rid yourself of your toxins, which is quite a heavy statement, especially for me at the time, because I was still coming out of the 60s drug use world, and you know, life was still a party, but it was killing me. So it was that moment that was very instrumental in changing my direction in life. And it's an interesting dance. But what you find is that it was never the drugs that made you fun, and or that made the moment that fun. It made a lot of the moments we forgot because of the drugs, but it wasn't necessarily the drugs. But at the same time, it was the drugs. You know, it was the times and the drugs, and, you know, it was terrific. It really opened up the consciousness, and I think it did that for everybody, whether you took the drugs or not. But I think just the collective consciousness was expanding by experience. People were experiencing some things that had never maybe been done. You know, leap back years later of perhaps, you know, before the industrial era, more of psychedelic mushrooms in the Native American time frame, where that was more common. But for us, it, you know, we're pretty white bread, but not after that. You know, the white bread turned pink and purple and blue. And, yeah. Oh, here's one with James Brown. And I was so excited. I got to get to cook for James Brown. And they show up, but they came through the kitchen because there was such a big crowd. And I decided to make this apple custard bread pudding with Jamaican rum sauce, you know, and the smell of that was just starting to spread around the kitchen. And as James walked by with his entourage, and he stopped at the kitchen and started smelling, and he goes, "My man, my man." And I couldn't believe it. James Brown in my kitchen. And he came over and he started to tell me that it smelled like his mom's bread pudding. And so we started getting on this subject of story smelling, you know, where it takes you back, the smell takes you back to a moment. Well, a couple of years ago, what happened to me was I lost a restaurant that was an experiment to begin with. I ended up losing everything financially. And then my wife left. And then my kidneys failed, all within the course of about 3 months. And it really takes you down to who you are, you know, what's left. And that's what I realized. What's left here is me. And I like me. And I've been the one driving all this stuff, and so it's still me. And so armed with just me, I left and came back to the Bay Area after being gone for 30 years. It's such an interesting dance right now. I have so many things I'm trying to accomplish. I've got to manage my time because of doing dialysis, and that's a huge deal. 3 times a week, 4 hours at a shot, you know, you sit and let a parasitic drone clean your blood, you know, and it's quite an experience. Yeah, you can ask why in some sense and all that, but instead of asking why, you begin to ask what with, and what with is what you have. You know what I started doing, the very first thing, and I don't think I've ever told anybody this, is that when this three-month nightmare ended, I began to get up at 5 in the morning when the sun would come up, and I would go out and just talk to the sun. To have somebody to talk to, some sense of connection. And I started to think that the sun gave me harmony. You know, whatever the reasons and whatever the slant is on spiritualism, whatever it is, none of it really matters, you know, unless you believe it. And so I would just absorb it, and with a clear mind, not asking, not anything, just absorb it, and it began to tune me up. I did that every morning, every morning, every morning. And what it has done for me, it has taken me to the place that I want to go. I feel that. I feel that I've taken myself there, but I think it has given me some clarity. And it was just a sense of nourishment almost, you know. I like the notion of a tune-up.
So Ray is working on a book, a combination of personal stories and recipes arising from them, and on a project for a TV series.
And we'll see. But again, I run into some great talent that is guiding me and moving it along. And I think there's a spirit here. It's not just the 60s. You know, it's really the end of the Oregon Trail. It's the beginning of the Bohemians. It's the entering into the psychedelic era. It's all the same thing. It's the same progression. I remember I was up in Vancouver, B.C., and I went into a meeting, and there was this investment banker, very conservative, heard that I'd cook for the dead, and so he stuck around until I got there. And when I arrived, he said, "I have to go, but I got to tell you something. That when I was younger, I had a band in Toronto." And then he stood up and he said, "I had to change my ways to make my money, but now I want to go back to who I am." And he put his hand on my shoulder and he began to weep. And, you know, this is in this very fancy restaurant, a place where he hangs out, and I didn't want to hug him or anything and make him feel more uncomfortable. But I got where he was coming from, that there's a lot of people out there that are afraid to be who they want to be, but they have such a passion and a appreciation for the time frame and for the freedom is what it is. It's just freedom, you know? Everybody wants to be free. And a lot of the folks are conservative looking and very straight, but they have a story. I refer to them as hidden hippies, and the hidden hippies are everywhere, but they're behind the veil, you know, they're under the fold. They can't surface, and it's so sad. So what I'm trying to do in my book and things like that is approach that person as well and make sure that person realizes that they too are part of the community, and in any way that they can surface is okay. You know, there's so much that is being lost by the conditions that America is going into, and it's difficult to see a flame burning in any of these corners. Everything looks so dark and hard now, but it's still burning. The flame is still burning. We're still here. We're all still here. You know, so.
In Petaluma, California, we were talking with Ray Sewell. His email is shayrayi8, that's C-H-E-Z-R-A-Y-I numeral 8, shayrayi8@comcast.net.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.